Welcome to Deloitte Global Insights, a production of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu Limited. Deloitte Global Insights is an audio news podcast that looks at important cross-border issues that affect the global business community. I'm Stephen Heasley, and I'll be your host for today's program, Managing the Uncertainty of Reform. What lies ahead for life sciences and healthcare? 2011 saw the passage into law of milestone healthcare legislation in the United States, and the beginnings of a sweeping overhaul of the entire U.S. healthcare system. For the implications for stakeholders across the global healthcare continuum, for payers, patients, and providers, and even device manufacturers, life science companies, and healthcare IT providers, are potentially pretty profound. Yet the process of reform is fraught with political risk. So how can life science and healthcare companies manage for this uncertainty? And what lies ahead for the global healthcare system after U.S. healthcare reform? On the 6th of June, 2012, the Financial Times, in association with Deloitte, will bring you the FT U.S. Healthcare and Life Sciences Conference. The one-day event, taking place in New York City, brings together an international lineup of industry experts, government decision makers, and leading market commentators to review the shifting sands of the healthcare industry and assess the bottom line impacts and implications for businesses and commercial strategies. Here today to discuss the conference themes are Terry Heise and Paul Keckley. Terry Heise is Vice Chairman and Life Sciences Sector Leader for Deloitte LLP in the United States. Thanks for being here, Terry.
It's great to be here, Stephen. Thank you.
And Paul Keckley is Executive Director for the Center of Health Solutions, the health services research arm of Deloitte LLP in the United States. Paul, we're glad you could make it here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, gentlemen, just give us a high-level overview. What can conference attendees expect?
Stephen, that's a great question. The program itself is one that's designed to really take a look at the changing landscape of healthcare as it's really playing out around the world, looking at it in the context of market changes in a number of the developed markets in England, across Europe, taking a look at it from a global standpoint with a particular lens on the health reform that's playing out in the form of two pieces of legislation and the market forces in the U.S. People that attend the conference are going to have an opportunity to take a number of different aspects of these changes and really view them through the lens of life science and healthcare companies and get a sense on what are they thinking, how are they thinking about things, what is it they need to do from really a number of leading experts and the people that are really shaping and implementing the policy. So it should be an outstanding program.
It sounds like a very exciting and certainly a timely topic. Now, as we mentioned in the intro, the implications of healthcare reform are potentially pretty profound, but the process is fraught with risk, with previously agreed exclusions such as government negotiations on pharma pricing, pay for delay, and even drug reimportation now caught in the political crossfire. So how can life science and healthcare companies prepare and manage the road ahead? So Paul, why don't we start with you?
Well, I think you have to put health reform in the context of three other moving parts. One is we're in the midst of a political campaign. So we have a number of positions being taken that are about government spending or about funding of various efforts. And that's always popular not to even suggest we'd need to fund other things with more money. Second is in the Stimulus Act that was passed a year before the Affordable Care Act, additional monies were made available to the NIH for expansion of basic research. So we've unlocked the logjam of basic research, and now we have a flood of new science coming into the system from the unlocking through those additional $10 billion. Third, you have appropriations discussions underway right now for FY13, where the funding for the FDA, the user fees, and all are topical. So that plus the Affordable Care Act, which puts in place massive changes to the delivery system, consolidation of the delivery system, the inaccessibility in many markets for detailers to bring their devices, their therapies to physicians directly, changes in the way GPOs and PBMs are structured, changes in the insurance system and then an overarching desire on the part of the regulators to reduce the net spend in healthcare. So, as you said, health reform is not just one law. It's a series of activities underway that reshape the U.S. market, which is 14% of its spend in device and biopharma, and then forcing a lot of these companies to think about other markets, expansion and outsourcing that would maybe be less risky.
Yeah, I think Paul outlined a number of key points, and one of the things that we've always talked with life science companies about is the fact that the legislation itself is just a catalyst in this process. It's not the forcing function. And for the life science companies, one of the things that I think they're looking at is competing in a market on a go-forward basis where transparency of information regarding product performance, the value, and the recognition that there's a dramatic series of changes happening in the ecosystem in terms of how influence happens for the utilization of products, who's going to make buying decisions. A lot of the things that happen in the legislation and through some of the congressional activities in the U.S. define a number of what's, we're still unclear on the how some of the things are going to play out. So it continues to be fairly uncertain, fraught with risk, Stephen, was the phrase you used. And I think it's one from our client standpoint that they need to recognize that the uncertainty itself translates to a variety of different scenarios and take the necessary steps to put themselves in a position from a product and organizational capability standpoint to be able to, in an appropriate way, respond to those changes that come about.
And certainly, you know, this isn't operating in a bubble, so it's fascinating to think about the ripple effect that these changes in the U.S. healthcare reform will actually have throughout the global healthcare system. Well, another one of the big conference themes I thought was pretty interesting is personalized medicine. So, you know, some 10 years after the unraveling of the human genome, important inroads are still being made in realizing the vision of personalized medicine. So talk to our listeners about this. What is personalized medicine, and when might it become commonplace, or what are some of the associated challenges and risks with this personalized medicine?
Well, it's an interesting term, personalized medicine, and some are using a different term now, precision medicine, and it essentially is the matching of a therapy, a drug, a bio, to an individual person's genotype, and that's fraught with risk, not just in the cost of developing, but we're still laboring through how to effectively map a genome in a way that's pragmatic. So personalized medicine is a destination where manufacturers will produce a drug for you or me, uniquely for you or me. But getting there's pretty tough, and Terry's folks have to deal with this every day.
Yeah, Paul outlines a number of really interesting aspects of the whole question of personalized medicine, and I do think it's precision medicine, it's targeted therapies, it's kind of going from the phenotypical development to one focused on genotypes. One of the things that we do see, though, is an opportunity for targeted therapies or precision medicine to also be a means to unlock parts of the market and actually help to advance some compounds, because in combination with diagnostics, we're going to be able to do a better job of understanding who are going to likely be responders to various therapies, and probably equally as important, who are individuals that should not receive a therapy so that we can exclude them. And the whole idea of precision medicine and being able to use that in combination with diagnostics and a concept called the REMS programs will actually, I think, help to unlock some markets. So there's opportunities to make advancements on compounds that are currently on the shelf, as well as set a long-term vision for much greater precision and much better genotypic targeting of therapies for segments of the population in response to disease conditions.
So some of these things that we tend to think of as a futuristic healthcare, what's going to be happening in the future, are actually here today. Well, one of the other big themes that the conference is going to address is comparative effectiveness research, which is often referred to as CER. And CER is becoming ever more firmly entrenched in the U.S. as a tool to encourage innovation and manage healthcare costs. So how is or how will CER be applied in payor decision-making and clinical practice? And what does it mean for the industry globally?
That's, Stephen, a great question. And I think comparative effectiveness broadly is probably going to be the big tipping point issue or question for the industry. And the way that we think about this is comparative effectiveness is really companies stepping back and utilizing information and insight into the performance of those products in the marketplace in terms of clinical effectiveness, safety, and in reality, the value in use component or the cost dimension to help understand what are choices that should be made. Comparative effectiveness research, a bit more precisely defined, a series of methodologies and standards that will define specific ways in which studies will be conducted, information will be presented. But the higher level of abstraction, I think, is not CER, but comparative effectiveness. And really, in the end, for the life science and healthcare companies, will help them to understand what is it that payers and providers need to understand about current inline products to make utilization and reimbursement decisions. It's going to help to inform life science companies around their late-stage clinical development programs, make certain that they're defining studies and gathering information to ask the questions necessary, not just simply to result in product approval, but really product adoption in the marketplace. And then the most advanced companies are driving those insights actually back into what they do from a research and corporate development standpoint in terms of where should they be investing their assets. You know, ultimately, comparative effectiveness is going to lead companies to the point where they're going to have to be far more intellectually honest with themselves around the value of their current portfolio, the value of their pipeline, and make much better capital and asset allocation decisions to drive the competitiveness of their particular company. I think in the past, you know, the industry has been one that's been focused on a lot of brute force and willpower to move things through the scientific pipeline, that the commercial operations were very focused on one-to-one physician conversations focused on messaging. With the significant consolidation that we're seeing happening in the marketplace, the new influence and decision-making models that are evolving through consolidation and the increased level of importance that administration plays in hospitals and information transparency, we're going from that one-to-one physician messaging to a point where information and facts trumps messaging and really creates a new future.
Let me just add a wrinkle that further complicates this. In the Affordable Care Act and in practice, comparative effectiveness is not just about the comparison of a compound to a control group. It's not my compound versus a controlled sample. It's your compound against any other solution to the clinical problem. So it could be that a non-conventional therapy is sitting beside your compound for comparative effectiveness research. It could be a non-invasive procedure that's done instead of taking a drug. So the way the law has set forth this effort called comparative effectiveness research under the aegis of the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute, PCORI, is that it's all-encompassing. It's all of the therapies that are appropriate to a certain patient population with these signs, symptoms, risk factors, and comorbidities. And this group of 21 is setting forth the priorities in the U.S. market for where CER is going to be applied. So it would be, I think, limiting to think this is just about biotech and pharma companies thinking about their compounds. As written, CER will encompass a whole wide range of treatments, some of which traditional biopharma companies have not considered part of their competitive universe.
Yeah, I think that's a series of great points. I think the other thing too, Paul, and I know you've made this point in scores of conversations that we've had, is that this type of analysis, while a bit more current in the U.S., is one that's really in practice in many places around the world. So as we take a look at where this is going to go from the U.S., I think there's also an opportunity for us to be informed by observations we can take, for example, from the U.K. market and the relationship between NICE and the National Health Service and how they take a look at things. Health technology assessments have been around for quite a while, and the ability to learn from that and recognize that real-world evidence being applied in this way is going to help to drive some of these decisions and actions as well.
Those are excellent insights, gentlemen. Thanks a lot, and thanks for providing such a solid overview of the conference topics. So it sounds like whether you're interested in healthcare reform in general, or a couple of the specific items like personalized or precision medicine or comparative effectiveness, it's going to be a great conference for a range of attendees. So as a reminder, the event is the 6th of June in New York City. I believe there's still some space available, so be sure to register if you're interested. And listeners can learn more about the conference and related thought leadership on our website, www.deloitte.com/lifesciences, or by following hashtag FTUSHC12 on Twitter. Terry and Paul, thank you so much for joining me today on Deloitte Global Insights.
Stephen, nice to be with you.
Thank you very much.
Visit www.deloitte.com/lifesciences to learn more about the FT Deloitte Life Sciences and Healthcare Conference, as well as additional insights from Deloitte on the life sciences and healthcare industry. Visit www.deloitte.com/global for more on Deloitte member firms' involvement in other industries and service lines. You've been listening to Deloitte Global Insights, the program that looks at today's important cross-border business issues. We want to hear from you. Contact us with your feedback or suggestions for future podcast topics and find Deloitte Global Insights at www.deloitte.com/podcasts. This has been a production of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu Limited. Thanks for listening and goodbye for now. Deloitte refers to one or more of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu Limited, a UK private company limited by guarantee and its network of member firms, each of which is a legally separate and independent entity. Please visit www.deloitte.com/about for a detailed description of the legal structure of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu Limited and its member firms.